All right, hey, what's up, everyone? So today on the pod, we are talking revolutionary science and theology. It's going to be a fun one. I have Joshua Mafawad-Paul with me in our conversation today, and I highly recommend reading The Communist Necessity and eventually getting through Continuity and Rupture, maybe with another comrade or two, which are two of Joshua's works. I realize that my understanding and practice of communism has very much been influenced by more revisionist strands of communism that are being produced in today's centers of imperialism and capitalism. And Josh's work, as well as the En Masse podcast hosted by Mubarak, have been timely interventions into my 2 years of engaging and studying Marxism. So in the show notes, I'll link other interviews of JMP's and also some of his books and his blog, MLM Mayhem. Last thing I'll say is we spend the first 30 to 40 minutes discussing what philosophy, science, and theology are, and why Marxism, Leninism, Maoism is a science, right? MLM. The shorthand is Maoism. Sometimes we'll refer to it as revolutionary communism, but it's really this scientific trajectory and this field of study called Marxism, Leninism, Maoism. And after that, the last hour dives into the differentiation between different kinds of failures, the relation between religion and the making of revolution, the class character of all theology. He has this great line where he says, "All theology is class theology." I found that whole kind of part just really excellent. And then we also discuss utopian socialisms, and then finally we wrap it up discussing cultural revolution, which has everything to do with social sites, just like the church. So it's a packed conversation, and I hope you'll check out his other interviews, and if you're down for socialism and communism, please pick up, maybe start off with The Communist Necessity. It's more polemical, and then eventually I really enjoyed the more thorough investigation he did in Continuity and Rupture. But okay, that's all I got. Here's my conversation with Joshua Mafawad-Paul. Well, Joshua Mafawad-Paul, I'm incredibly honored to be speaking with you this morning. And today, you know, we've got a really fun conversation ahead of us that we kind of meshed out through the email about revolutionary science and religion and some ideological line struggle and utopianism, all really important and really fun stuff, I think. But reading two of your works, The Communist Necessity and Continuity and Rupture, this past month were really clarifying moments for me. And I would say both actually for my faith and my kind of like my theologies, but also my politics. And I had read Marxists and Marx prior to January 2019, but it's basically been about like 2.5 years since I began to intentionally engage and study Marxism. And while I had read all of these fundamental texts on revolution versus reformism, right? That's a popular conversation being had, a really important one, of course. And then also science versus utopianism. Your work helped reveal my personal embedded revisionism, which on one hand, I'm thinking it was theoretically and politically clarifying for me and the work I feel personally called to do. But also on the other, it was emotionally stimulating because it was another moment in my journey where I could look back and see how tendencies of my analysis and practice were wrong, but like the specifics as to why it was wrong. And so I say all that because I think Maoism's emphasis on criticism and self-criticism inside revolutionary organizing is so freeing, really, you know, and illuminating and, of course, essential. So thank you for your work you've done thus far. And I'm really grateful to be able to introduce the Faith and Capital listeners to your incredibly important and timely work.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. So before we get rolling, could you just go ahead and kind of introduce yourself?
Yeah, as you said, my name is Josh Mufawad-Paul, or Joshua Mufawad-Paul, or J. Mufawad-Paul is the pen name that I use. I have my PhD in philosophy, and, you know, I finished that in 2010. And so I teach in philosophy as, you know, contract faculty, because tenure jobs are hard to get, especially if you have politics like mine. And I've been writing a lot and reflecting a lot on, you know, politics and organizing and political ideology, and therefore the ideology I ascribe to is Marxism, Leninism, Maoism. I've written a lot why I think that is the position to ascribe to, and that's kind of how the kind of activist and organizing work I do is, you know, connected to that kind of that kind of cadre programmatic thinking.
And as I already mentioned, you know, we're going to talk about religion and revolutionary science and Maoism and stuff like that. But I thought to kind of get us started, you know, one thing I really appreciated about continuity and rupture was your clarification on the role of the philosopher, right, as a philosopher, and then also the purpose of philosophy. And in the realm of religion, theological beliefs, as I'm sure you and many of our listeners know, are often believed to be scientific beliefs, right? So, for example, rather than speaking of God or Jesus or biblical stories theologically or, religiously, most Christians in the world today suggest that they are speaking of God, like a God being scientifically. Another example would be how the two creation stories found in the book of Genesis are often used to explain nothing theologically about kind of who the writers believed we ought to be or who God was or how we ought to live and why the world is the way they thought it was, but rather it's scientifically used to explain how existence began, right? So I thought maybe you could start us off by reflecting on how you understand and differentiate science, philosophy, and theology.
Yeah, this is an interesting question. It's actually interesting the way you put it about like the two creation stories in Genesis and, you know, the way that that biblical texts are seen to be, you know, describing actual history or science, which I always think is funny. I mean, that's a very much more like closer to the 20th century view than, you know, ancient theologians would have thought. I mean, we didn't have the concept of history as we have it today when the Bible was written, right? The idea that history, the way that it's written, that things are completely literal, this is something that emerges much more recently in time. Like, you don't even find it with the ancient Greeks, except for Thucydides tries to do it, right? But then you have Hesiod that emerges all this stuff. So it's like, and also science, the modern notion of science didn't exist back then. So it's a very weird way of reading kind of our current sensibility of things back on a text instead of just letting that text be what it is. And I think this really has to do with the way that these categories were, you know, originally they weren't always separate. Like when you say science, philosophy, and theology, they weren't understood separate. I mean, this separation emerged over time. And actually, my book, Demarcation and Demystification, kind of looks at that a little bit in more detail. Not specifically theology, but like philosophy and, well, the also philosophy and its connection to religion and things like that. And it's how we should understand it now. But so I'll try to, you know, bring in a little bit from what I wrote in that book and also to connect it to your question. And, you know, I want to say that, you know, what we now call theology, it was once a stand-in for both philosophy and science, since it attempted to provide answers for what science now explains, as well as the interpretive function that philosophy has now historically provided. So, but in this sense, you know, natural phenomena in this kind of way of seeing things would be explained according to supernatural causes, and thus part of the business of ancient theology would be attempts to explain reality largely through theological categories, right? And what I mean by that is, like, you know, if there was a drought, like at the time, like the kind of way of thinking, like if there's a drought, the explanation would be some kind of supernatural explanation, right? Mm-hmm. Anything, right? You know, God's angry, the gods were angry. And you have like things in many different religious texts, like telling you stories of God or the gods being upset with people and, you know, natural disasters being the example of their wrath. You know, but also that kind of thinking would also explain things like the structure of the cosmos, right? So, you know, the notion, there's, you know, at one point there was the notion of the permanence of the heavenly spheres, and that had to do with this idea of like this old religious idea that things that weren't in movement and things that weren't changing were the most real, right? And that's kind of, you know, so they had the idea that you couldn't have the movement, like there was this permanence of a static permanence of the heavenly bodies, right? And that's the kind of static conception that you find in Aristotle, even though Aristotle's trying to separate himself as a philosopher from this thinking, and kind of reflects that theological worldview. And this continues, this way of seeing the cosmos through theological categories, it continues right up to the period where Catholic church officials were horrified by the Copernican hypothesis, right? Because it actually, it decentered their theological conception of the universe, where they had declared that Earth was the center, right? And it was privileged. Mm-hmm. Sight of God's providence. That's why, like, the Copernican hypothesis was seen as such blasphemy, right? So it's like all of these notions of seeing the world and, you know, like this kind of scientific conception and philosophical conception, at one point they're kind of, you know, merged all together with theology. And they still kind of, there's still this messiness there, but, you know, I like to separate them for reasons, right? And it also becomes important when we start talking about social phenomena, right? So we're looking at that kind of natural phenomena, but then we have you know, social phenomena was seen according to this dominantly theological way of understanding the world. And this hasn't necessarily gone away either with a lot of people that have that kind of thinking, right? But it was perceived in the same way nature was. And this is largely because the distinction between natural and social is a distinction that was made much closer in time. You know, the ancient world throughout the globe predominantly treated human society and history according to whatever religious theology was dominant. I should also note here that I'm not saying that this distinction between the natural and social is necessarily a good distinction, and I, you know, it has its own problems, and I'm gonna mention that a little bit later if I have time. But you know, the way in which they were conflated in the past, like the past conflation of them, it generated this kind of mystification that would result in the more modern categorical distinction between natural and social as a reaction to that mystification, right? Because according to the ancient view, if a society was doing well, right, they would just claim that it was because it was following some notion of natural law. And if a society was falling apart, it was because they would claim it violated the natural order. And you have this in these texts, like look at Antigone, Sophocles' Antigone. It's Thebes is falling apart because the gods are angry at it. And they have this notion of a cultural plague, right? Miasma that's released when the city state disappoints the natural order. And also you find that different, that's, you know, that's the ancient Greeks, but you find it everywhere. Like you find it in like Thomistic theology. The great chain of being is, you know, this notion of like legitimating the social hierarchy and claiming it's written into the natural order, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the same with Confucius's law of heaven. And you find this across the board in every single religion with these kind of ways of like almost mystifying social categories as well. Okay, so I'm kind of like maybe getting off track. So I'll maybe talk about like philosophy and then, you know, science as well on that. So one of the things that interests about philosophy is that, you know, a number of people have argued that, you know, philosophy emerged from religion in an attempt to provide non-religious explanations for reality. And in that sense, it was earlier always in competition with religion, right? It was always trying to steal kind of religion's thunder in that. So if we look at, you know, the Western canon, you know, I have friends whose, you know, work is in like non-Western philosophy too, and they say there's this similarity happens there, but since I'm not trained in that, I can't say it as well as they can. So I can mainly just focus on kind of the Western canon's emergent story of philosophy. But you know, when it emerges in the West, and I said that I've heard similar stories about its emergence in other places too. It attempts to provide quasi-scientific explanations, right? But it's also not really that as well. But it's trying to be non-religious too. But you find this in the work of like the pre-Socratic philosophers of the Ionian Enlightenment. And you know what they're trying to do is they're trying to, you know, kind of almost provide a different account than the poets, right? And the poets back then weren't understand like we understood poetry. The poets were the people that went around. People thought they were touched by the gods, so they'd go around and speak, and people thought they were listening to like the inspiration of the gods, and that's why you get the Homeric poems are supposed to be like these texts. But the problem with that for early philosophers is their argument was like, well, all these poets can't agree. they're all claiming it's speaking for God, so there's something really wrong about this that's not providing clarity. So the whole Ionian Enlightenment is like, we're going to do this thing where we're going to start doing logic, right? And they're going to try to... steal that thunder, right? But the reality is that because it still emerged from a theology worldview and initially, as I said, saw itself in competition with religion for monopoly on truth, philosophy also had an aspect of the theological in it. And right, and you see this for a long time, right? And you know, still people will say this today and go into it, like you have ontology, right? Like the study of being, it was considered the apex of philosophical thought. And ontology sought to do, like the old, not the way that, say, analytic philosophy now understands ontology, but the old kind of all the way up to Heidegger, the system-building kind of ontology. It sought to do what religious theology had traditionally done, but without a specific religious commitment. That is, it sought to provide kind of a metaphysical scaffolding for reality. And you can find this, but like Plato's theory of forms is like, you know, a good iconic example of that. Aristotle's ruminations in the metaphysics. And you find this, you run this all the way up to like kind of this, the early modern ontological work of like Kant, who sought to provide, you know, a metaphysical foundation to the European Enlightenment. and then Hegel after that, and then find like Heidegger and all these people who are doing this kind of ontological system building. And I think what we have here underneath this is, even though it's attempting to separate itself from theology, still this kind of theological thinking in philosophy. You know, Ashton T. Crawley, I don't know if you're familiar with Ashton T. Crawley. He's you know, he writes, he's a black queer theorist who writes about theology, actually. His book, Black Pentecostal Breath. So,
oh yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Yeah.
Anyhow, he talks in there about what he calls it this theological-philosophical kind of thinking. And it's where the categorical thinking of theology overdetermines philosophical investigation. So that's, you know, and he brings it in to talk about other social stuff like race, all this kind of stuff as well. Okay, in any sense, you know, despite this ontological history, right, what we now call science did come out of that kind of tradition of philosophy that I'm charting. And most strongly during the European Enlightenment, though there were precursors in different areas of the world. And also, you know, I'm not saying this as in there's something special about Europe. Actually, the special thing about Europe is that it was stealing things from the rest of the world at this time, which is why the Enlightenment is driven by wholesale theft of knowledges, right? But that's a issue other people have brought up. So I just want to make that caveat that, you know, that the reason we get this is also there's something very deeply troubling at the same time to the emergence of modernity and the way that it emerged. Anyhow, it emerges, this kind of category of science, you know, emerges strongly during the European Enlightenment with the assertion that natural phenomena should be explained according to natural causes. And also things like social historical phenomena should be explained according to social historical causes. And here you feel this line gets drawn by philosophers between theology and science, where the business of the immaterial world belonged to theology and the business of the material world belonged to science. The line wasn't that clear, right, at the time, and there was a lot of confusion over its meaning, as well as confusion over the politics that was going on at the time, but it still was a meaningful distinction to make, right, for the development of the new sciences. But because it was overdetermined by the what I mentioned, this theological philosophy of ontology, it was troubled by other categorical distinctions. So for example, you get the distinction between the social and the natural that I mentioned earlier. In some sense, it's a great way to distinguish yourself from that early mystified version of it, but it leads to this other really weird separation. Instead of a rethinking, it becomes this like this strange separation, or, you know, it's a bad reflection, right?
I've heard that distinction in my conversation with people about revolutionary science. I know we'll get to that in a little bit, but that revolutionary science, because it's much more of a social science, it's more of an inferior, it's not really a science, which is what some people in fields who are doing more natural sciences have told me. So it's an interesting that you say that.
Yeah, actually, and I will talk about that later too, because that's a common thing to say that as well. Anyhow, maybe it's connected to this distinction, right? This distinction which made sense in response to the confusion of religious mystification, but it almost remystifies a lot of assumptions, and a lot of assumptions that are made according to colonial and capitalist notions of mastery, where like human artifice, like the things that humans make, is seen as separate and superior from the so-called natural world, not as if it actually is part of it or emerged from it, right? And this mapped onto predatory categories such as civilized and savage, you know, with the European powers seeing themselves as civilized and other civilizations they encounter being part of savagery. And savagery was actually understood as the natural world that was untamed and uncultivated, that which should be appropriated, meaning, you know, and cultivated, which means like invaded and colonized, right? So that's why this separation, while it has one side, I mean, it's always the dialectical thing with me, these kind of things. You see this one side that is like, that leads to some kind of progress. You see this kind of other side that is, you know, a very negative side as well. And these things kind of, they are in contradiction with each other and they need to be teased out. Okay, so I've been going a lot on this question.
Oh, no, it's good.
Anyhow, maybe just to wrap this up, I'm just going to say that, you know, while it was the case, the philosophers who asserted this kind of, you know, distinction of science, right, to go back to that, the distinction that, you know, natural phenomena should be, you know, explained according to natural causes, they still, you know, while they asserted that, they still embarked on their, you know, ontological system building And that ontological system building was usually influenced by dominant ideology at the time, which you see right through Kant and Hegel. That initial intervention was still significant. The Copernican hypothesis, really did shake up the way of seeing the world, although some philosophers rushed into this shaking up and, you know, tried to use it to enforce their own non-religious ontologies, right? With Kant saying he's going to provide the Copernican hypothesis to philosophy and all that kind of stuff. But we do have, you know, a bit later after kind of Kant and Hegel, you have Feuerbach, who, you know, becomes an important stepping stone in, you know, Marx and Engels' development. You know, he proclaims that, you know, Hegel's ontology and all ontologies, he actually refers to them as speculative theology. This kind of way of getting into it. That's his critique of it. He's like, this is speculative theology or like non-religious theology. And so his attempt in, like, say, the essence of Christianity, where he argues that theological categories are in fact representations of human species being working itself over time is a response to that. But even that intervention, you know, and as we know, Marx and Engels would argue, was still hampered by ideology and that kind of speculative thinking as well. But, you know, it's another story altogether. In any case, with this historical inheritance in mind, you know, I guess I can say that, you know, science is now the name of the study that produces truth procedures that can be measured and known. Theology is the inheritance of the ancient world that sometimes bleeds into philosophy, that is about the hermeneutics of religious mystery, and philosophy is the practice of investigation and clarification that might sometimes side with science and other times might fall into theology. And I think if I say anything more, we might be getting to other questions now.
No, that's excellent. That was really helpful, especially that clip of that summarization there. And I think it's an important thing for folks to wrestle with, even if, you know, you're out there and you've never read any philosophy, or, you know, you're not in the field of science, or maybe you're not a religious person, right? But all of these fields, whether they've been conflated or whether, you know, they've been used differentially, have been used to reproduce class and social rule, right? They've been used politically. And I think that's what I'm always kind of interested in is, especially, it seems that, like, when theology fails to serve something like capitalism or white supremacy or cis-heteropatriarchy, right? Then science can be brought in to explain things, or when science fails, then philosophy. And there's always, I think, a political battle over these three realms. So I think it's just something that's really important. Also, clarifying the understanding of how they are different is really important. And that's kind of our next question here. So how is revolutionary communism, right? Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, or shorthand Maoism, a science? And why exactly is that important for waging and winning the war against capitalism, establishing socialism, and pursuing communism?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, a humongous question. It's funny, it's one of the ones I've done a lot of interviews on this question, and, you know, I've written a lot about it. That's why people want it to all come up. I try to say something a bit different about it each time. Otherwise, it becomes redundant. But I don't know. I'll try to answer this because it's, you know, really, really big question. And if a lot is missing, then I just refer people to, like, my work and previous things. I didn't answer this or I didn't answer that. I mean, there's a reason why I've written so much on it, is because questions keep coming up that need to be addressed by it, right? It's really a philosophical intervention for me, because a lot has already been written claiming this by Marx and Engels and a whole tradition. So it's me giving kind of this philosophical clarity. So I want to begin by saying that I think in order to answer this question, or answer the beginning of it, the first part about seeing it as a science, and then your second part is about its importance for establishing socialism and pursuing communism. So we want to talk about the first part, right? We need to understand science in the way that Marx and Engels understood it, rather than how it gets conflated with the examples of the so-called hard sciences. Right? Because usually when, and you mentioned this earlier, right? When someone says historical materialism is a science, the immediate answer is no. And the reason for this, no, it's not, is simply because the answer they give is like, well, it's not biology, physics, or chemistry. Mm. But that's not a really good argument, right? Because all this denial is doing is giving examples of particular sciences and saying that since historical materialism does not look identically like them, then it doesn't qualify. I mean, why not just go the whole hog and say physics is the only thing that counts as science, and since chemistry and biology don't resemble it, then they're not science, right? Which is a claim to make, but it's making this, they do things differently, right? They have different studies, different laboratories, but, you know, it's a bizarre thing to say, right? And it is, it's bad because, like, aside from that example I gave, you can see how bad it is when you apply it just to other categories. Like, for example, if I said that, you know, a particular expression of the visual arts is an art because it does not resemble, like, a few things that I decide are art within it. Like, I'm saying, you know, only Renaissance art and abstract expressionism count as art. Mm. Bizarre claim to make. I mean, but then I can just say, well, that's not art. And, you know, and people do say that. Really bad cultural critics who don't study art say that. You find that all the time. It's like something, a new art movement's happened, and someone's like, well, this isn't art, right?
Yeah.
But it is, right? And people point out how dumb of an argument that is, right? Or like, let's look at the religious one, right? If I said, you know, Buddhism isn't a religion because the only thing that counts is monotheistic religious expression, that would look rather odd. It would, you know, there'd be a lot of problems with it. You know, Orientalism would be one. I mean, also, like, you know, historical stupidity would be another. So, you know, I think it's like, once we see it in these other categories, we can see how dumb it is to actually say, historical materialism doesn't count as a science just because of these examples. Now, of course, that still means we have to explain why it's a science, but I'm just saying the argument that it's not because it doesn't represent these expressions is a bad argument to begin with. But still, the onus is on people claiming it's a historical, you know, a science to explain why, right? So I think, you know, going back to kind of understanding what science is, you know, we should return to this, you know, a categorical understanding of science as an overarching concept of a variety of systems of concepts. And I'm borrowing that from, like, you know, Jean Cavaillé's language. You know, he was a philosopher. He was actually a scientist and philosopher who wrote about, you know, the logic and meaning of what science was. Actually wrote this really difficult essay about it, as someone who's a mathematician. And he wrote this stuff on science, interestingly enough, when he was imprisoned by the Nazis for fighting in the French Resistance. He was a partisan. And, you know, the thing he wrote in prison before he was executed was not a treatise on politics, but was this book on what is science. Anyhow, side point. Anyhow. So earlier I mentioned that science produces truth procedures that can be measured and known. Now, expanding on this notion, we can say that science is that which demystifies the world, as I mentioned earlier, by providing natural explanations for natural phenomena. Biology, for example, provides biological explanations for biological phenomena. And instead of looking for causes extrinsic to biology, seeks to ground causation within the terrain of biological investigation. That is, developments in a biological organism aren't explained by appealing to sin or grace as they would have been according to a non-scientific religious worldview. Historical materialism then establishes social and historical explanations for social and historical phenomena, and like every scientific train, began by establishing key axioms that were foundational in demystifying the object of investigation. For Marx and Engels, one of the main axioms here was that the motion of history and society was class struggle, and from there a history of investigating this object of study was founded. But it's more than just establishing the basic laws of motion, and all the sciences that are now accepted as scientific have gone much further than just, you know, their original core axioms, right? Mm-hmm. Like, back to Cavaillé, he writes that the unity of science is movement. That is, quote, there's a quote from him, if we are considering realized science rather than a scientific ideal, incompleteness and the need for further progress form part of the definition. And that's the quote from him. And what that means there is that, you know, an idealist notion of science would see science as a completed project, and I'd treat it more like an ontology or theology, right? You know, what philosophy used to do when it tried to make scientific judgments, right? But the reality is much more profane, I would say, kind of reality as opposed to sacred. Like, science is open to the future. It is always in development and grasping successive insights while also developing concrete methodologies and technologies that actually work through these insights. For science, truth is a process, and ways in which to know and measure this process are developed as part of this process. You know, again, to cite Cavaillé, he writes, you know, to know the world, to understand the world, this is a program that already represents the abandonment of complete creative autonomy. And what does he mean there? He means that science is not an anything goes discipline, but it develops methods that are admissible because they can demonstrate their admissibility. The instruments and technologies we have because of science are proof of this. And the fact that we can be having this conversation over technology that allows us to speak to each other, record our conversation, and then broadcast it is, you know, evidence of his truth process. But of course, now what does that mean? What does that have to do with historical materialism, which, you know, we call revolutionary science? Well, you know, I've argued, you know, I'm just going to do this. I'm not going to be giving you the full extent of my argument, but it is, you know, the one that, you know, I make in Continuity and Rupture, and I make in, you know, I return to it again in Critique of Maoist Reason. And I also have like some other essays and things about it as well. I've argued that historical materialism is also open to the future and has established its own truth process according to its fundamental axiom of class struggle. There have been world historical revolutions that have established socialism. These revolutions have been repeated based on what was established, and there have been successive revolutions that have gone further. Such experiments have been falsifiable because attempts that did not follow what these revolutions established failed to make it as far as these attempts. And revolutions that went further were able to do that repeatability, right? The testability and repeatability were able to develop successive truths and then meet with their own failures that they were unable to answer at the time. What we have with Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, which I consider to be the current name of the process of revolutionary science, is two successful world historical communist revolutions following the Paris Commune and the world historical bourgeois French Revolution and the world historical anti-colonial revolution in Haiti. And I've demonstrated that, you know, that, sorry, not me, but these have demonstrated that class struggle is the motive force of history by transforming the world, if only temporarily, and running into impediments after overcoming previous failures. Now, what makes historical materialism different from the so-called hard sciences is that despite the fact that it shares the general characteristics I've just outlined, because it is dealing with all of human history and society, and because its laboratory is class struggle, its scientific practice is much more expansive, where historical time is, you know, privileged over geometric space. You know, I've tried to work out this expansive understanding of, I mean, in terms of laboratory, I mean, both, you know, obviously all histories of science have like this, you know, long historical time, but I mean, like where you work, where you do your work in the laboratory, it's like you can have a space of a lab in biology that you work in, right? You don't have it. It's much more expansive when you're talking about class struggle, the laboratory, society itself. Yeah. So I've tried to work out this expansive understanding of historical materialism and science, as I mentioned in Continuity and Rupture and other work. And it's an ongoing project of mine. So it'll, you know, I return to it quite frequently and respond to criticisms and think of new things and stuff about that. But, you know, largely my point has been that if we really want to end capitalism and move towards a better and more humane world, we really do need to take seriously a scientific methodology of making revolution, which has been established by past revolutionary movements, because they've shown us what they've done successfully and how to get to certain points, right? And we need to go further. We need to experiment and go further than these things, but we can't neglect what already has been shown us as world transformative moments.
Yeah, excellent. I think I found it personally just so helpful for me, even in these last few months, when thinking or when talking with others about, okay, what's our strategy, right? What we've been doing been successful? Is it principled? Is it based on anything, or are we just kind of trying to come up with random ass ideas? Is it based on any kind of investigation into our context, right? Have we learned anything from past struggles or other struggles? And I think that's what is really, it's fairly simple. Thinking about historical materialism as a science, or Marxism as a science, it really does make sense. When I love the examples that you use, I think in Continuity and Rupture, when you talked about, was it Newton and Einstein, right? The transition between Newton and Einstein, right? There's a continuing of some fundamentals, but also there's significant rupturing. And that in the process of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, there's this belief that there actually are universal truths that can be particularly applied in particular contexts, and they've been proven, right? There's this kind of laboratory, which is the revolutionary class struggle, that certain truths have been proven to be necessary. And then there are other things that have revealed to be not necessary, right? Unnecessary, or actually have proven to be just a total failure, right? Yeah. Whether that be the kind of organization or kind of strategy. And I think that's been really helpful for me, because now, you know, we bring all that, right, this talk about science and stuff, all the way to my hometown, Charlotte, North Carolina. And instead of saying, let's just try anything and everything, rather than saying, well, maybe any method or just doing anything is good. Actually, we've learned from history, from the immense energy and an investment of past people's struggles. We've learned that some things are good and some things are bad. Some things might work and some things are destined to fail. And I think that helps us, if we're actually interested in crushing our enemies and winning a world where housing is for all and winning a world where we can decommodify our relationships. If we're actually interested in winning this war, then I think that we have to take this question of scientific praxis really seriously. So yeah. Excellent. Yeah. So in continuity and rupture, you differentiate between different kinds of failures and how understanding failures of particular historical struggles differently shapes our analysis of past struggles, both revolutionary and non. So could you tell us a little bit about how all failures aren't the same and why this is important for us to understand?
Yeah, I mean, this is important, right? Because considering that the liberal view of communism, right, is to presume that it was you get this narrative of the great failure, you know, there's even a,
yes.
After, you know, the collapse, you know, even before the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, there was a book produced called, like, The God That Failed, meaning communism is a kind of like that language, right? Very, and this, you know, this view is like this, you know, communism fails, capitalism is the end of history, right? They had that proclamation, the same proclamation that was used to declare the New World Order in the words of George H.W. Bush. So I think, you know, it's important to really think through the meaning of this failure or the failures of past revolutionary movements, rather than simply accepting pithy sayings like communism is good in theory but bad in practice, you know, or the problem with communism is human nature. And they're always put out as if they're these profound things, but it's not really profound when it's over and over and over and over again, and people think it's original because it's not, right? They're not historical assessments, claims like that. And they actually just originated from anti-communist propaganda.
Absolutely.
Right? It's like the horseshoe theory that, you know, like everyone's sociology teacher told them, at least when I was, you know, right, like, you know, at the end of the Cold War, when I was, you know, a kid, and they'd be like, you know, it's the communism and fascism are the same. It's like the continuums are like a horse. It's like that bullshit, right?
Absolutely.
It's also true, right, that the great revolutionary movements in the past did meet with failure, right? Yes. Otherwise, they'd still be here, right? Or, you know, they'd still be here, you know, developing, and they wouldn't have collapsed or shifted into revisionist shadows of their former selves. But the question for me is what kind of failures they were, rather than accepting the fatalist and, you know, rather unscientific interpretation that they were destined for failure. This is largely because the two great world historical communist revolutions, along with those other revolutions that happened within the shadows of their sequences, they established great successes and insights before they met with failures. They had successes as well. So that is, we need to look at them like scientific paradigms that meet questions they cannot solve with their particular sequences, and thus meet with failure because the tools to answer the questions they eventually raise have not yet been developed. You know, much like a scientist laboring under the Ptolemaic paradigm eventually met with failure and could not solve numerous problems with astronomy within that particular scientific sequence, right? This is kind of like, you got to look at it like that. And it's the reason why it's different, it's the same in, you know, abstractly, but different in concretely is that, you know, the stakes aren't the same, right? So, you know, when someone who's working within, you know, a scientific paradigm that has made its end and they can't answer these questions, and they continuously meet with failure, it's not like a whole society is falling apart, right? It's not like, you know, the imperialist camp is closing in. There's other things, right? You know, there's other social events around it, but it's not the same, right? So in that kind of, if you look at it that way, right, you get this kind of that let's look at that, you know, metaphorical Ptolemaic scientist, right, who encounters these, you know, these things and failures to their experiments because that, you know, that is astronomical view of the world doesn't answer questions. Like, we try to fix certain things with, you know, theory of retrograde motion and all that, but there's tons of stuff they can't answer, right? The Copernican rupture was required. You know, and it's just like the Ptolemaic paradigm is a rupture from the Aristotelian view of the cosmos, right? And both provided important but partial insights, right? And again, this has to do with science being open to the future. You get these successes and then you meet this kind of failure. So that's kind of a metaphor I want to look at this in. So we need to look at, you know, these world historical revolutions and their successes and failures, like scientific paradigms that meet questions they cannot solve within their particular sequences, and thus meet with failure because the tools to answer the questions they eventually raise have not been developed. And it's like repeating that. I mean, I already said that, but I want to just repeat that.
Sounds helpful. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, the Russian Revolution established a variety of successes that through the repetition of the technologies of what that revolution brought to the table, you have like the concept of the party vanguard, the concept of the state as a machine for proletarian class rule, to name a couple. And these could be replicated by a variety of other revolutionary movements around the world. The method of establishing socialism, you know, called the dictatorship of the proletariat, was figured out and it could be replicated. The problem, however, was that new questions were encountered and the attempts to answer them eventually led to failure. The Second World Historical Communist Revolution, though, after successfully utilizing the social technologies learned from the Russian Revolution, was also world historical in that it established new conceptions by going further. It correctly recognized by proving through struggle that class struggle persisted under socialism, and not simply as external pressure from the capitalist camp, but internal to the dictatorship of the proletariat. The development of concepts such as the mass line, two-line struggle, and cultural revolution emerged from this revolutionary sequence and now require further elaboration and development, along with perhaps new concepts, in a future world historical revolution that will only be thus if it goes beyond the paradigm that we understand now is established by the Chinese Revolution. You know, in any case, the sense of failure that, you know, we're talking about here, since it is akin to the failures or limitations encountered by other scientific terrains, should be treated as in dialectical relationship with revolutionary successes, right? Failure seems more momentous than the dialectic of success and failure you find in the laboratories of the natural sciences, as I pointed out earlier, right? Because it concerns social classes and history and these massive events that concern millions of people. But as I pointed out, the abstract principle is the same. You know, barriers in thought are encountered in every scientific sequence that are only overcome through the event of a new development in these sciences. You know, what Kuhn called a paradigm shift, or what Bachelard called like epistemic rupture. So the sense of scientific failure is always linked to scientific success, since it is only through these types of failures or impediments that a paradigm shift or possible paradigm shift can be encountered. And it's different from the kind of failure that has repeatedly been proven to be wholesale failure without any success, right? So, for example, you know, the anarchist notion that society can be transformed through a non-hierarchical and non-party politics has never once succeeded in getting close to what the communist sequence have achieved, right? It hasn't even established a state of affairs that would lead to the kind of catastrophic failure, and catastrophic because it was a fall from actual successes that the Russian and Chinese revolutions, along with those other revolutions inspired by these events, achieved. Now, it's like, you know, the anarchists, we'll go back to, say, the Spanish Revolution. But, you know, and the Spanish Revolution was this great, you know, obviously should be upheld as this great struggle against fascism. But the reality is that they weren't able, they kind of reached this, the realization at the end that they needed to do exactly what the Russian Revolution did. And like establish like you know, a state that was a machine for the repression of the enemies, and they didn't do that well enough, right? They weren't able to do that, and that's one of the reasons why they failed. So they didn't get as far. But that is as far as that kind of anarchist thinking can take you. It needs and it'll have to encounter that question about the state machine, which was established through and then he finds that question of the state machine is proven over and over with all the failures that don't do it, right? That don't get as far. But you know, I think another thing of failure we can talk about is the notion that society can be transformed through social reform, right? That's another like a failure that is not the kind of failure I'm talking about. It's one that is just always a failure, right? And this idea that the idea that you can work within the system to establish communism or socialism, it's met with abject failure every time it has been pursued. It has not delivered any success, right? You saw this even at the very beginning, the emergence of communism, right? With Marx and Engels' conception of communism, it was against this kind of view, right? The League of the Just and its notion of utopianism, of a common humanity, right? Had this reformist view going on. It's they had to, that was like at the end of the day, Proudhon was pushing that notion, right? That's what Marx was Marx was responding to in the poverty of philosophy, right? But also you saw it also with the SDP, right? The Socialist Democratic, the Socialist Party of Democracy, or SPD, right? In Germany, and its capitulation to fascism, right? With the, you know, the how it capitulated, right? This kind of reformist view with Bernstein and then Kautsky. And then now you see it with every social democratic attempt to work peacefully within the system. And it's been tested and shown to be a complete failure, and yet people still pursue it, right? And interestingly enough, these approaches to making revolution are pursued as an alternative to communism because of the discourse that communism is a great failure. and yet they've refused to grapple with the fact that they haven't established a single success. They're like, communism is a failure, so let's do this thing that has already never had any successes, right? It's a bizarre position, right? It's a bit like, in, you know, my mind, to like really be vulgar about it, it's a bit like a phrenologist claiming we should take them seriously because of current problems in biological science, right? Which is a ludicrous claim. But, you know, even though it's ludicrous, you still get publications like Quillette that want us to reconsider skull measurement. So it happens in other sciences as well. Anyway, I think that might cover your question about failure.
No, that's really helpful, especially the example you gave about social reform, because there is, especially in kind of centers of capitalism and imperialism, there's still this broad hope in, well, let's participate in electoralism, right? Maybe you can get a socialist mayor elected, or maybe even a self-identified democratic socialist named Bernie Sanders. You know, if you can just get him elected as president, then we are marching on our way towards socialism or something like that. And then also there's even folks who would disagree with socialist politics happening in the U.S. Some folks look at other countries and say, well, socialist parties have been elected into power, and therefore socialism has been, you know, they would say socialism has been, you know, historically realized through electoralism. But I think if we engage what you're saying, that we realize that there are going to be certain problems, even if you are able to elect a socialist party, historically we've learned that there are certain parties or certain problems and failures that are very likely to occur because you haven't smashed the bourgeoisie, right? You still have incredibly powerful bourgeois class in the economy, in social spheres, in politics that remain, whether they're kind of internal capitalists or foreign capitalists that are still in your space. And so anyways, I think that way of engaging that failures, not all failures are the same. There's different kinds of failures. And that we, learning from the past, learning from past historical struggles, is not a way of kind of undermining or trying to battle out and say, well, who's right and who is right and who's wrong, to kind of in a chauvinistic way. But really, no, if we're serious about winning, I guess that's what I keep on coming back to, is being critical and self-critical. It's about how can we win? How can we make a revolutionary proletariat and win a world of socialism in a pursuit of communism? So anyways, I think it's a really important and helpful clarification, and something I think I'll definitely personally continue to wrestle with. Moving forward, so what roles do you think religion might be able to play in waging a revolutionary struggle? And what roles do you think religion should not try and assume?
Yeah, this is a big question. I think, first of all, I think it just needs to be said right out of the gate that the business of waging revolutionary struggle belongs primarily to a revolutionary party. And history has shown us that this is the case. So struggles led by religious organizations, when religious organizations lead struggles, right, they tend to be mystified, you know, and you can have that, like, say, look at, like, you know, Thomas Münzer and that kind of the movement in the peasant wars in Germany. They tend to be mystified, but at worst, they can become theocratic and fundamentalist, as we kind of see, right? And this is because I think we can start thinking about this, and then we can look later at the role that, you know, religious people and religious groups, progressive religious groups, can play. But I think I first want to talk about what we can consider the difference between, the partisan of a religious organization and the partisan of a revolutionary communist party. And I mean, someone can be religious and, you know, and be a partisan of revolution and communism as their main partisan position, as opposed to the, you know, it's where they put the weight, right? So, and, you know, it's the partisan of a religious organization, which I'll talk to about first, primarily what I mean by this is someone that primarily wants to see their religion grown because they feel their religion will make the world a better place. So even if they appeal to social justice, they also believe that what ultimately unites people is a sacred rather than profane community. So for example, most Christians, you know, tend to believe that people in the world will be better off if they believe in the Christian doctrine, and that this doctrine is the prime point of unity. So, I mean, I'm saying this as, you know, it's pure, like I grew up in a Christian church, right? Now, my parents weren't reactionaries, right? They weren't, you know, I met a lot of reactionaries in this church, though, but as I continue to meet reactionaries throughout life in every single avenue, because they're all over the place, right? You know, my parents, they weren't reactionaries, as I said. You know, they taught me many of the progressive values that I still possess. Right. You know, it's probably because of them. Even, you know, they laugh at this. They, you know, they put me on a road that, you know, eventually back and forth, I ended up going further to the left than them. I mean, it's funny because, you know, there is this people make that argument that, well, if your parents are left, you're going to turn in because of childhood rebellion, you're going to turn into some rightist. And I don't think that's true because there's so many right wing people that whose parents were right wing.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's like circumstances and class struggle. But I think it's like my parents did instill in me values. And, if you know, and I just went further, I followed out those values in a way that I thought made better sense than them, right? And so, you know, for them, in their time, you know, they struggled against the perspective of Christian conservatives. They were influenced by the Christian social justice movement of the 70s and 80s. You know, they were particularly influenced by Ron Sider's book, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. But they also believed, because of that, that the first and most important point of unity between them and others was in their community of faith. This idea that we're all unified in Christ because, you know, going to heaven or that kind of abstract kingdom of heaven is better than other things, right? So, you know, while they worked to make this community of faith better, they saw no contradiction in being in a church with people who held reactionary and anti-people viewpoints. They saw these viewpoints as wrong and something to argue and struggle against, but they saw the people expressing these viewpoints, because of being a partisan of this kind of religious view, they saw them as brothers and sisters who they could be in community with because of a shared dedication to an abstract kingdom of heaven was for them what mattered most. They largely felt that pursuing this kingdom of heaven would eventually address the problems they had, but that since the spiritual was more important than the political, their focus was on the spiritual, right? Mm-hmm. So, for me, right, the entire notion of being in community, and this is something that, you know, eventually led to me, you know, almost rejecting the whole thing and becoming an anarchist before moving towards Marxism, right? It's like, for me, the entire notion of being in community with reactionaries simply because they believe in the same abstract theological creed is nonsense. It's
absolutely
right. And of course, I realize churches have at different moments in history, some churches within the broader community have drawn better lines of demarcation, like, right? You just got to look at black churches in the U.S. during the civil rights movement, right? They refused to be in community with white supremacist Christians, yes. Right? Proving that politics really does trump an abstract notion of spirituality when it comes to safety and survival, right? Like, why should someone be in community with someone that wants to lynch them? It's ludicrous, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, even with like the civil rights movement and some of these churches, you know, that drew this line, and, you know, other churches that weren't necessarily black, but had a kind of that bent that drew that line as well, you know, a religious notion of common humanity and the sanctity of life often overweighed the necessity of armed struggle, right? So you get that kind of the pacifist side of the civil rights movement in those communities. But in any case, primarily orientating yourself according to a religious partisan theology, you might have, orienting yourself according to religious partisan expression, right, will result in placing theology over politics to some degree, whatever theology. And the more the religious partisan puts politics in command over theology, the more they actually move away from being a religious partisan. That is, if they decide that all religious expressions are equal to their own, for example, but, you know, there's might be the truest one, but everyone's still going to get into heaven, but the universalist idea, right? If they start moving towards that, right, they move away from being a partisan of their particular religion, and they become some form of religious universalist. And the more they decide that spirituality is the business of God, and it's not up to them to struggle for spiritual conversion, the more they move towards privileging non-religious partisanship. Mm-hmm. You know, if they use religious language, such as arguing that the kingdom of heaven means building communism for everyone on earth, they're still moving away from being religious partisans, right? At this point, they might as well retain their faith as a private matter, even if it isn't a matter anymore, and champion a secular political movement. And, you know, that faith can guide them in the reason they they choose to have be part of this movement, but they're putting the politics in command, right? And they may say they are drawn to those politics because of a spiritual conviction, right? And that's where their values come from, and they can have that kind of theological centering. But they become a religious person who's a political partisan, right? It's something else.
Yeah.
So you know, and I would argue actually, everyone's always a political partisan, even those that claim that they're putting, you know, religion first. But that's the
absolutely
question, right? I mean, expressly communist partisan, right? So the partisan of a revolutionary communist party, which is what I'm getting at, is, you know, is united under a secular program about making communism for everyone. The idea that you can be in community with someone who holds anti-people ideas because of an abstract spiritual conception of unity is, as I said, bizarre, right? For this kind of partisan. That doesn't mean you can't be in a thing where people have different ideas that you have to struggle together against. You have to struggle with people that have backwards ideas in order for them to become communist. That struggle is important. Right? It's a mass line kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean that you see that, oh, because this person is a white supremacist, I can be friends with them. It's like, no, that person is the enemy, right?
Yes.
When you see those people, you draw these lines that people are the enemies in the way of freedom, right? They're not comrades, but enemies. And they stand in the way of making a better world. Not because of individual hatred of them, but because of what they represent, and because they're an impediment, and the class that they're involved in, the class commitments they have are in the way of a better world. So, you know, such a partisan does not care if their comrade has different beliefs about theological or philosophical notions, unless these notions are in opposition to the masses and building revolution for communism, right? You know, I think it's also worth saying that there's a holdover. This is a bit of a tangent, but I think it's worth thinking about the way this partisan religious thinking still lingers, even with people that claim they aren't, right? And there's a holdover of it within a number of crude communist thinkers and groups. So, you know, there's a number of communists, they would agree theoretically that partisan commitment to a non-religious communist project is better than committing to a religious social justice project. They end up adopting kind of a notion of class unity that has a religious tinge, right, to it, in the way they understand the proletariat or something. And what they do is they seem to think it's okay to unite with anyone in the working class, even if these people have anti-people views that are racist, homophobic, sexist, transphobic, or whatever, right? And that just by being down with communism or being vaguely working class, that's enough for a point of unity, right? And they have this idea that almost backward ideas will disappear because some magical working class essence will fix every problem at some predestined point. And this is precisely the same kind of thinking, but a different, it's almost the secularized form of it, but it's still the same kind of thinking that my parents and others had about their religious community and the notion that building the spiritual kingdom of God will fix the wrong thinking of reactionaries through some magical wand of grace, right? This is why, as a Maoist, you know, I'm also a Leninist, right? And I argue for a particular conception of the vanguard party that begins by uniting the most advanced, right? The point is to place politics in command, and this can only be done if you are a communist partisan first and foremost. There are going to be people that come from a working class background who will fight tooth and nail against communism. Look at police, right? Look at people in the army. These are they're no longer the proletariat, right? They are they are the machinery of the state, right? Designed put down any revolution. So none of this is to say, and let's go back to the thing about having a religious commitment. I just want to emphasize that it's not to say that, you know, religious organizations dedicated to making the world better, or who think that their notion of the kingdom God or whatever means communism, don't have a role to play, right? They can and have, you know, play useful roles in a united front. Liberation theology has taught us this, right? And, you know, progressive churches in the Philippines, for example, play an important role in the New Democratic Front by using their influence on fellow believers to struggle for communism under the leadership of the Communist Party, mm-hmm. and then using religious language in the struggle, since that language does speak to large groups of people whose religious expression is indeed, you know, as Marx noted, the sigh of the oppressed creature. But this kind of liberation theology viewpoint, again, it privileges political partisanship over an abstract religious partisanship. Mm. And I should say, if you hear dings going on, there's this, my computer, it's queued to the iPad my daughter uses. And that's her cousin calling her on FaceTime.
That's hilarious.
So it's like, I guess I'm down in the basement, but it's like.
No worries, yeah.
I think this is really interesting and really important conversation to be had. You know, I think the reason why this question popped in my mind after engaging your work was I'm familiar with these Christian socialisms that are out there that have argued that Christianity is should be like the foundation of their of socialism or something like that, or like to have a socialist society it must be distinctively and exclusively Christian, which is just so absurd to me, but it's probably growing and it's probably really popular. I think it's pretty popular in places in Europe. So anyways, yeah, I wanted to engage this question because I think it's really important, and I think that kind of what I hear you saying, that partisanship along lines of religion is really, really dangerous, and it is way more reactionary in my mind. But partisan along lines of our politics is way more important. You know, I went to growing up in a white evangelical reactionary space, you know, I transitioned to a more liberal space. And one of the good things that came from that was I engaged interfaith dialogue, right? I deconstructed this religious supremacy, both like of my own particular faith and of religion in general. But I think it's really important to emphasize that perhaps there are primary and secondary contradictions, right? Or primary and secondary modes of kind of unity. And I think the politics must be primary over our theological beliefs or our particular religion. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And so I'm glad that you shared what you shared. That was helpful. So could you tell us about the importance, you actually started to suggest this, but the importance and the role of waging ideological line struggle over more or less political, you know, correct political lines, and how line struggle over the political line differs from struggle over a theological line or a framework, right? Because, you know, in seminary, but also if you are familiar with any kind of like church history, you know, and you're familiar, if you're like slightly aware of today, there's this battle, right, between different theologies. There's just this historical battle between, well, who has the right understanding of God or the truest theology? And then there's actually a pushback to say, you know, there is no correct, there is no more helpful way of thinking about God. Everything's just kind of, our thoughts are just random and meaningless and they have no purpose. So it really doesn't matter what you say about God or people or right. So anyways, yeah, could you speak to how the line struggles within the church historically are different from the line struggle that needs to happen in communist or just broadly left circles, and then why the political line struggle is actually important? Because I also know a lot of socialists who push back and say, actually, you know, let's just be open to anything and everything, and hopefully we can maybe spontaneously win a better world or something. So, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, I kind of already kind of indicated why that spontaneous view was bad earlier, but if we like sharpen around the notion of line struggle, I mean, I think one thing that I say, it's line struggle, it's always operating in any organization, types of line struggles, right? No organization is static. And even if they imagine themselves to be static, there are still dynamic debates about, you know, I'm going to begin thinking about political organizations first before talking about the theological question and binding them together. Like theology organizations, they do have politics too, which we can get into. But I mean, this, we're talking about specifically like political partisan organizations.
Absolutely.
Really, right? Yeah. You know, there's even when the line struggle is denied, there's going to be dynamic debates that, you know, show these line struggles. It might not be conceived as line struggle or even accepted as existing, but it's always there. Because there are always active debates within any movement that reflect the politics of society as a whole. You know, it's like I've been through by now kind of an entire organizational gamut of multiple groups, from like movementist to communist and all that kind of stuff. And I've witnessed this always existing line struggle. You know, one thing that is essential to the Maoist turn in communist theory is that it seeks to recognize this line struggle as fundamental and a possible dynamic motor of a revolutionary organization. You know, the problem, however, is in understanding how this line struggle functions, and it's always a difficult thing to get your handle on. You know, for example, some struggles within an organization might be non-antagonistic, and some might be antagonistic, and these might also transform. Non-antagonistic ones can become antagonistic, and antagonistic ones can become non-antagonistic. And so a mature understanding of line struggle and antagonism is required. And I think we often fail to make the correct assessments because it's just messy. It's like hard to do, and, you know, and I don't even know if I've made the best ones over the course of my life as an organizer. Like sometimes I'll look back and I'll think that I was involved in treating, you know, a non-antagonistic contradiction as antagonistic, or that I vacillated and in the interest of a vague notion of unity treated an antagonistic contradiction as non-antagonistic. Mm. And I always think back on these kind of things. But, you know, outside of my own experiences, right, because my experiences are, you know, it's very small compared to the history of living communism, right? And in that history, we can see that it's played itself out according to a series of line struggles, and we can learn a lot from those. And that's how we learn for those kind of struggles. So there's a line struggle in the League of the Just, I mentioned that earlier, between the faction led by Marx and Engels and the faction devoted to Proudhon and Whitling. And that line struggle led to the Communist League, right? And then there is the line struggle between the faction of the communist movement in Germany led by Luxemburg and Liebknecht against the faction of Bernstein and Kautsky. And that provided us with the first working conceptions of revisionism. Then there was the line struggle between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks, between Stalin and Trotsky, between China and the Soviet Union, between Mao and Liu, and the list goes on and on, right up until the line struggles that are happening today within kind of the Maoist international communist movement. But, you know, I could go on forever about that. Just the point is that it's this ongoing thing, right? So the point that it's an ongoing thing is that, you know, line struggle is inescapable because every society to date is founded on a general class antagonism. So the ideologies generated by classes are always in struggle. And this is going to be refracted on every level of social life and how we think our understanding of our social life. Although it is most consciously understood in political struggle, it can be most consciously understood in political struggle, it's also reflected in philosophical and theological conceptions of existence, right? And I want to differentiate, like these philosophical and theological conceptions are also political, but they may not consciously be conceived as such. As opposed if you consciously conceive yourself in political struggle, you will be quite obviously think about the politics of line struggle, as opposed to if you think your philosophy and theology is outside of politics, you're not thinking about that your line struggle is political, but it is, right?
Yes, yes.
So, you know, this, I guess, gets to your question about theological line struggle and your comments about that, right? And there's tons of theologies, and there always has been, and, you know, I mean, from the very emergence of a specific religion, you see different theologies emerging as well. And I think we can say that the history of theology, it really does reflect the history of class struggle. You know, it generally differs from that, what I mentioned, that conscious line struggle of open political lines, because theology tends to be more mystified and has historically not understood itself to be a reflection of the clash between social classes. But once we recognize that theology is a set of historical phenomena, like even if you're going to believe the idea that it's like the word is, you know, the word of God, the Bible is it comes from God, it still was written by humans who were involved. If you're going to take that line, you can't deny that. Well, people do deny it, but let's just say that there's people that wrote it in a specific time, right? Even if they were inspired by God, right? The point is, no matter how you see it, you should recognize it. It's a set of historical phenomena we cannot escape, right? And so then it's developed according to some form of like line struggle or class struggle in society. So the struggle between the conception of the great chain of being and the Protestant work ethic, right? And that represented the shift between a feudal worldview and a capitalist worldview, right? And the war between these two theological conceptions was very meaningful, right? So like every theological conception of reality is a class conception at the end of the day, or and then the last instance reflects that. The question is whether they conceive themselves as thus or seek to return to the realm of abstract theological debate. There have been so many theological, and this goes, but there have been, you know, the thing about it always being political, so many theological line struggles that are also political. You know, just looking at the history of Christianity, you brought some stuff up, and I'm familiar with that more than the history of any other religion, because that's what I was raised in my upbringing, right? Even then, even when I was still enmeshed within that church and that kind of social democrat Christian worldview as a kid, I started to realize that maybe these things kind of represent really historical clashes, right? That's going on.
Absolutely.
I understood it very foggily, right? You know, I mentioned the struggle between the feudal and capitalist theological perspectives, but there are obviously ones that, you know, more concern, you know, human liberation now, that are much more contemporary to that. Like, you know, ones closer to our time, right? Like there'd be the struggle between a theology that justified the plantation system and a theology developed by abolitionists. Right, or the early, and then later you'd have the struggle between the theological perspective of the Black Church during the Civil Rights Movement and the mainstream white supremacist church. You know, Ashton T. Crawley, who I mentioned earlier, He writes about the struggle of Black Pentecostalism against the theology, philosophy of white Christianity, right? And just kind of, so, and that was, of course, the stakes were political, right? Mm-hmm. And they were driven by political things. And, you know, we can talk about the struggle against the white evangelical theological framework that, you know, it originated in the U.S. and somewhat in Canada. It's much stronger in the U.S., but definitely it's in Canada as well. It's important because it's pushed its political theology of reaction onto large parts of the world due to its missionary industry, right? So that's, there's a definite political stakes concerned in that. So many of these theological perspectives, though, especially if they accommodate dominant power relations, they like to imagine that politics is secondary and theology is foundational, that they have the true hermeneutic of the religious text. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that the readings are determined by their political perspective and are historically contingent. Like, it's not a happy accident that the dominant theology in the U.S. during the plantation era was one that functioned to justify slavery as natural, right? It's like where did that come from, right? Oh, because there was slavery. And it was used to justify that, as all ruling class ideologies was. So it's not a timeless and abstract theological truth, for example, to assert that abortion is a sin, right? It's one that white evangelicals do, because you can actually point to moments in history when the church authorities decided in response to social phenomena to codify abortion as murder. You see this in, you know, I mean, Silvia Federici's Caliban and the Witch, she talks about actually these conventions that were held in the Catholic Church where they decided abortion was a sin. Before that, it wasn't seen that. And it was actually connected to the early commons enclosures in England in response to the need for a future workforce and to discipline women and the autonomy of midwives. It was actually, exactly. Before that, it didn't exist as a sin. And then that was still seen for a long time in the Protestant world. Like, abortion was A-OK for Protestants for a long time because they saw it as a Catholic thing.
Right? Yeah.
So, you know, when Roe v. Wade happened in the States, people forget that most Protestants didn't care about it. They thought it was just a Catholic problem, right? Because, you know, for them, it would abortion, that kind of worldview, abortion would have still been seen as just part of the mechanics of birth control, which Protestants were fine with, right? Where Catholics were, they wrote their theology that they, you know, ascribed to birth control in that time of the enclosure of the commons. It wasn't just abortion, it was everything that they decided was a sin, was because it was, you know, the natural, the predestination of like a sperm needing to become a baby with all these Aristotelian notions, right? Mm. So Protestants didn't have that at that time. But, you know, they eventually took it up, and there's a lot of work saying that, you know, they took it up because they saw it as a cause to unite U.S. mainstream white Christianity after segregation was no longer feasible, right? Became this new kind of thing. And those are just some examples, you know, but the point that I'm trying to make is that every theology is a class theology, and line struggle operates within the theological terrain as with anywhere else. So I think, you know, the more important question is whether struggles against those theological perspectives that reflect ruling class power will consciously see themselves as political struggles and unite with a broader movement. And this goes back to my thing about the partisan, you know, the partisan, religious partisan versus political partisan, and the points you kind of pointed out about, you know, Christians like not necessarily wanting to struggle about this and saying everything goes, right? I mean, there's a tendency amongst even those theologians who reject the reactionary theologies to see this as a matter of only theology and like anterior to political struggle. So again, you know, that the partisan commitment to religion can stand in the way of militant political partisanship. The theologian who sees the reactionary worldview as just a perversion of their religion often sees it as this kind of war between brothers or theological debate, and conceives as those of those defending the reactionary theological line as, you know, confused fellow travelers, when in fact they're not fellow travelers at all. They're enemies, right? Political enemies. So this kind of well-meaning theologian might even complain that politics is the problem because they see those invested in reactionary theology engaged in lobbying and and binding the theological perspective to capitalism, colonialism, and imperialism. Like a lot of social gospel ideologues, you know, that I've been familiar with because of that, and also, you know, my brother's still invested in that view, so I hear about these people, and I have debates with my brother all the time, right? While struggling theologically, you know, these social gospel ideologues, they struggle theologically against reactionary theological perspectives, tend to think that politics is the problem, and that Christians should stay out of politics as if the political sphere is a separate space from the private sphere of faith. And that's actually, that's a bourgeois myth, that whole separation is yes. That's core to bourgeois society. It's a very political position to have. The truth is that I think reactionary theologians understand things, what they're doing, politically. They understand themselves being political partisans to some sense, more correctly than, you know, the social gospel people, insofar as they understand, even if they pretend that the theology is natural and foundational, that political partisanship is necessary, right? Those who absent themselves from the struggle because they think politics is the problem, believing that there can be a pure theology, fail to recognize what is at stake and are making a very liberal political decision. There can be no theology outside of class struggle. And so the only way to struggle against predatory theological perspectives is not to argue for a pure theology outside of politics, but to engage with politics. And again, let's not forget that abolitionist churches during the struggle against slavery did not allow pro-slavery Christians to be part of their community. Right? They saw such people, and despite the limitations of like white abolitionists at that period of time too, be critiqued, they still saw these kinds of people as individuals who were fallen and could not be in communion with them because they could not recognize a shared humanity. Right. And so similarly, anti-segregationist churches involved in the civil rights movement did not see pro-segregationist Christians as part of their communion of faith. Because how can you worship beside someone who thinks you should be lynched, as I mentioned earlier, for desiring equal treatment? And also, you know, connected to this, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., everyone always likes, you know, despite all, he's such a pacifist, he loved, everyone likes to kind of say that. You know, you got to remember that he polemicized against the white moderate liberal Christian who believed that such a unity in a reformist politics connected to this unity was possible. His letter to Birmingham jail, like, totally attacks those kinds of people, right?
Absolutely.
In any case, I guess maybe to wrap this up, you know, I think it's liberation theology that if we're talking about some species that comes out of like a theological tradition, any type, you know, that gets these questions of theological commitment and line struggle correct much better than the social gospel church does. I mean, maybe that social gospel church thing, I think it's always like this, it's got this correct amongst kind of the Christian community and those that I see invested in it, like the people I know that are still in the Christian community, right? Like my brother, they got so many insights about the world, right, but then they don't take them to their conclusion. I think, you know, you go further, if you want to push further down that line, maybe that social gospel thinking should hopefully open up, if you're doing your job, to liberation theology, if you still want to be some kind of committed person in a community of faith, right? And it's that kind of viewpoint that gets questions of theological commitment and line struggle correct. And that's probably, you know, why, you know, I was drawn to liberation theology as a kid while still enmeshed in the church, just reading that kind of stuff. And then that was before I went anarchist. And then after realizing the problems with anarchism, moved toward Marxism, right? Long history that. Although, I now maintain, right, that the Revolutionary Party cannot be religious, right? It has to be secular. And it can't be, you know, it doesn't mean it can't admit people that, I mean, that's a different question. The question of whether or not the Communist Party can have people that believe certain religious things.
Sure.
It's a different debate, which I'm not talking about. I'm just saying the party itself cannot be religious. And I definitely think, you know, line struggle within religious communities led by those dedicated to a liberation theology viewpoint can be important for a united front.
That is, yeah, brilliantly well put. I want to just re-emphasize the last 15 minutes, just a little bit of what you just said. On one hand, ideological line struggle, right? Political line struggle is historically an essential aspect of Marxism itself. Right, you started all the way back from Marx and Engels and their line struggles through Luxembourg and Stalin and right all the way to the present front. So I think that's really important for us as communists and socialists to understand. There is no doing socialism or communism without engaging in political line struggle. And on the other hand, your emphasis on how all theology is class theology, right? That it's not whether or not you want your theology to serve political ends. It's in whose interests are they serving? I think that is really fundamental for us to continually be wrestling with as Christians, and also the first part as people who are participating in organizing in the struggle. So excellent. If we could, there's an interesting kind of dynamic where folks who are religious and want to participate and want to pursue something other than capitalism, and they may call it like a religious form of socialism, it tends to be utopian, or it can often be kind of co-opted by revisionism, as opposed to using more historical materialist and scientific methods to understanding what capitalism and socialism are and how we can actually establish socialism. So could you talk to us a little bit about what is utopianism, perhaps at first, and then why do you think that there's a tendency among a lot of self-identified religious socialists to move towards that religious or that utopian form of socialism? And just to give one example, I think there's a growing interest in the communism of the Bible, right? Primitive communism. And more people are like, well, okay, I guess the early Christians were communist. And I think that, of course, there needs to be a distinction, a differentiation between the two different kinds of communism that were occurring. One, a primitive and ancient communism where things may have been shared collectively, as I think genuinely happened, but they weren't produced collectively, right? There, you know, capitalism was far from ever even close to being emerging. So we're talking about a different kind of communism. And that we can't just kind of create a commune out in rural Kentucky or in Utah and say, hey, we have achieved communism because we share all things, right? So anyways, yeah, could you tell us a little bit about utopian socialism and how that differs a little bit from scientific socialism?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in your question there, so.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
I'm just going to, you know, focus. Okay, so I think it's one thing that I think is worth saying. You talk about this idea about, you know, the way that early Christians lived and people that are tempted to be like them again. It's funny how these things keep repeating themselves. Because my parents, when I was young, that was the view of the social justice movement within the church in the 70s and 80s. It was inherited from kind of a hippie view of dropping out and starting communes. My parents, they did that too. They started, you know, kind of this commune kind of lifestyle to, like, you know, to basically like try to have these original kind of Christian movement. I mean, they didn't do everything in a commune. It wasn't a cult. People came in and out. They had worked elsewhere. The church was, they were part of, but other people weren't living in community as well. It was just like kind of this idea to like have this idea where you try to like escape kind of the connections of capitalism and pool resources and things like that.
It's so popular. Yeah, it's really popular.
Like at that time, my parents were doing it. A lot of like kind of like left-leaning people in the Christian church were doing it. And just like the hippies that did it back then, it fell apart eventually. It didn't change the fundamental relationships of capitalism around it. It was a lifestyle kind of socialism, right? There's a utopian impulse to that. Yeah, I mean, utopianism is kind of that idea, the distinction that, say, Engels makes between scientific socialism versus utopian socialism is that, you know, the utopian socialism of LaSalle and all these people like that, Saint Simone, it was kind of like they begin by imagining what a community of the just would look like and then try to organize towards this imagined community of the just rather than making a scientific assessment of society and what needed to be done with society to get to this, this no place, this, you know, And that's why there'd be a lot of like focusing on like writing down what that society would look like and what people would do and experiments. Again, the same thing that we're doing, the experiments of Robert Owen starting a commune somewhere else, right? But maybe talk about this kind of religious impulse, utopian impulse and stuff, which I don't think the utopian impulse is bad in of itself. I think utopian socialism is bad, but, you know, I feel like Frederick Jameson have distinguished between that utopian socialism and a utopian impulse that is still within communism. This is, they're very different things, right? It's important not to conflate them. But I think it's worth noting that in the past, you know, before the emergence of scientific socialism, the religious and revolutionary partisan commitments were conflated, right? They're very conflated, right? You know, Engels points out, for example, that the world of ancient Rome and ancient socialism, that in the world of ancient Rome, there was an ancient socialism, and that he said that was expressed by Christianity at that time. Clearly, that Christianity was different from the dominant forms of Christianity that are expressed today. That's why people say, let's go back to that. But that's because, you know, maybe you can't, right? The mainstream, you know, variants of Christianity are bound up with capitalism and imperialism now, right? But when it first appeared, it had this utopian socialist impulse, right? Its adherents resisted dominant politics, and they held property in common. You mentioned they opposed the state, like Oregon, or is it Origen or Oregon? I can never
think of the name. Origen,
Origen. He castigated, you know, ancient Christians who desired to become state bureaucrats or members of the military, right? It's kind of view that he had. There was a shift when Christianity was legalized and became under Constantine a state religion. And then you see all the developments of Christianity since then bound up with state power, except for, you know, reactions to it. Like, but, you know, but even after, because even after, we find utopian impulses realized in resistant religion, right? So like Engels talks in the Peasant Wars in Germany, like his essays on the Peasant Wars in Germany. He talks about, you know, Thomas Münzer and others for, you know, rearticulating this utopian impulse and being, again, examples of utopian socialism. But he points out the limitations. They still have this, they don't have a proletarian line. They don't understand, they understand class struggle to a certain extent. But they don't do that full scientific assessment of society. And you can find similar examples of utopian socialist communities and other religious traditions that were opposed to dominant power, but who could only speak in the language of religion and explain their opposition through that language of religion. The problem, though, is that these utopian impulses don't go far enough, right? As I'm just already saying. And they don't go far because they're mystified and non-scientific. Historical materialism, like so many other sciences, emerged in confrontation with mystified apprehensions of its object of investigation. You know, Marx and Engels had this, you know, they had to struggle against this utopian inheritance, despite recognizing its importance, so as to establish, you know, the Communist League, as I mentioned, upon the ruins of the League of the Just. You know, there's that, you know, kind of these moments where, you know, Engels delivers this speech at the League of the Just and it switches over to the Communist League. And, you know, the argument is about people are saying all men are brothers. And then he says, you know, is the bourgeois and proletariat brothers? He's like, no, they're enemies. Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, it's like, and it's, so, you know, although the utopian socialists of Marx's and Engels' time were not the same as the ancient Christians or the movement of Thomas Münzer, they had a similar perspective, right? A utopic notion of a common humanity shared by everyone that was violated by predatory power. So the shift from that League of Just to the Communist League was based on understanding, as I just mentioned, that humanity was divided by classes, that it was not enough to recognize common humanity and justice, but there could not and that there could not be any common humanity when humanity was divided by classes. So I think today there remains a temptation to be utopian in this original sense of the term. And I think that, you know, it's not just within religious communities. So I can see religion has this, it's, you know, like the counter theology of, say, Christianity has this history of the utopian impulse. So it's probably what it tries when it's, you know, attacking dominant white evangelicalism, it might draw on those traditions, but it's still going to be a problem, right? Is there something better than it? But it's that utopianism, it is a temptation, I think, dominantly, not just in the Christian community, but everywhere else, to believe that everything can be solved by ethical arguments about justice and common humanity. As a common humanity, that's in philosophy departments, you find people think that, right? And this, you know, it's not simply religious utopianism, but a general humanist reformism, right, that needs to be struggled against. Because that kind of impulse always leads to a reformist, which, you know, revisionist, very, like, that's the hallmark of revisionism, that kind of reformist idea that you can change society from within. And we can't recognize a common humanity until we first realize that human interests are split according to class concerns.
So just to reiterate, I think what you just said at the very end, that there's a tendency to emphasize on wrong ideas. Like the problem is simply that we have bad ethics or that we don't want the right world. And so the solution is to either individually or in a small group, whether of friends or in a larger group, right, escape this world and then emphasize on offering a better way of thinking about the world. And if you can just talk about how sharing things in common, if you tweet about enough, if you make enough, you know, videos, if you write enough books about sharing all things in common, then eventually with enough readership, right, you can kind of say, wow, you know, I don't like capitalism or I don't like imperialism. You know, I don't like being a settler in a settler colonial society. We're just going to choose some other world, right, without any kind of revolutionary struggle, especially, I think, among pacifists, which Christianity in settler and imperialist countries are really prone to, this idea of pacifism, that we can just choose this better world without engaging in fundamental revolutionary class struggle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to wrap this conversation up, I had one last question on the importance of cultural revolution. So yeah, could you kind of tell us a little bit about the role that cultural revolution plays and seeing religious, particularly seeing how religious organizations and institutions and communities might play in cultural revolution and understanding those sites as sites for class struggle? Because we've talked about this before on the show. I just did a conversation with a a theologian from the Philippines, and we talked about understanding the church as a site for class struggle. But yeah, could you kind of offer us a little bit about the religious kind of participation in cultural revolution, or what role religious sites and communities might play?
Yeah, I think I'll start, you know, maybe talking about, because it might be that, you know, people who are listening to this, I don't know, or they're coming in, might be like, what am I talking about cultural revolution before I talk about the religion? So I'm going to try to like talk a bit about the way I see cultural revolution, and then then speak to the question about, you know, the role of religious organizations and institutions and communities. So I think, you know, one of the, for those, you know, aren't familiar, you know, you obviously are, but who knows people reading that, one of the very important notions that the sequence of the Chinese Revolution brought to the table is this concept of cultural revolution. You know, in conceiving that socialism was still a class society wherein the bourgeoisie could return because bourgeois ideology would linger even after a successful class war, the necessity to struggle against this ideology and establish new social relationships and new ways of seeing the world became paramount. So the point is that if we're all socialized into a way of being that is bourgeois, petty bourgeois, you know, in the case of Chinese Revolution, also semi-feudal, right? Mm-hmm. Then we move to, and we make a revolution, right? And we succeed in it. We do all the things, we do the steps, and we establish the dictatorship of the proletariat. It's not like we easily discard the way we've been socialized to interact, right? Yes. That subjectivity, that bourgeois subjectivity that we've taken on, because that way of being a person makes so much sense in bourgeois society, right? Even if you are working class or something, you still have to compete and have that bourgeois notion of agency, and you're forced to because you have to survive, right? And so many ideologies linger, and we come, even if we reject them theoretically, we don't necessarily reject them practically. This is a notion that, you know, the Chinese Revolution understands, is that these ideas, these ideologies, they come in to the new revolutionary society and they need to be struggled against in order to build kind of a new humanity that is away from all of that kind of predatory thinking that we have like inherited. So the revolution needs to continue in every institution to break with old ideas. In fact, there's like, you know, famous Chinese cultural revolution film called Breaking with Old Ideas and all the struggle of breaking with these old ideas. So the Cultural Revolution in China, despite theorizing this fact and launching a massive campaign that bombarded the party headquarters and created a massive revolutionary upheaval within the revolution, it failed. And it failed, though, in that sense that I was talking about earlier, right? There were great successes, but still we have this failure. And for example, and when I talk about there was great successes despite this failure, because there's all this wound literature produced by the Cultural Revolution by bourgeois ideologues about how bad it was for someone's family. And then as, this is the funniest one. You always feel like, oh man, my parents lived through the Cultural Revolution. It was terrible for them. They had to go down to the countryside and help farmers.
Oh my God.
There's Mo Bugao's book, The Unknown Culture, The Battle for China's Past is really good because he starts the story at the beginning saying someone says this at a conference, right, about how their parents were treated badly. And then someone in the audience stands up and says, what class position were your parents?
Yeah.
Oh, they were intellectuals in the city. And the person was like, my parents were peasants and they had a great time. So it's like this different perspectives of that.
Yes.
But outside of that wound literature, you know, the great successes that happened, right? Dong Ping Han wrote this book called The Unknown Cultural Revolution. And he examines like just empirically all the productive work that happened during this period when this revolution within the revolution attempted to close the gap between the city and the countryside, to re-educate privileged city cadre by sending them down to the countryside to help build necessary infrastructure, and all the hospitals and schools that were built as part of this large-scale struggle. Society was improved even amongst the chaos and factionalism that the whirlwind of the Cultural Revolution could not help but unleash. Like even still, the line struggle between Mao's faction and Liu and Deng's faction eventually resulted in the victory of, you know, Liu and Deng, and the scapegoating of the Gang of Four, the revolution being detoured down the capitalist road, and a lot of the infrastructure that was built in the countryside being halted and dismantled eventually, right? And being neoliberalized eventually as it came out later on. Okay, so what this tells us, at least how those of us who are Maoists understand things, is that the entire concept of cultural revolution must be pursued as part and parcel of a revolutionary movement. You know, we should be combating ruling class ideology within our movements and seeking to develop a truly revolutionary and anti-capitalist culture from the get-go. Now, of course, there are multiple articles and interventions produced in the course of the Chinese Revolution, even before the Cultural Revolution, that already pointed to this insight before Cultural Revolution was theorized, right? You can just name a few, right? Combat liberalism, serve the people, on correcting mistaken ideas in the party. Mm-hmm. And those are just some of the articles, right, that sought to establish the necessity of a revolutionary perspective and subjectivity. But also practices were theorized during the sequence, such as the mass line, criticism and self-criticism, all these things which are meant to cultivate this perspective of a different subjectivity, which is why now, you know, many contemporary Maoists, they center these articles and practices in their organizational work so that cultural revolution is not an additive event, but organically linked to how we engage with the world, right? And since I don't want to be overly simplistic here. Because there's also a gap between theory and practice, as in every kind of organization, when it comes to, say, this cultural revolution insight, because it is very hard to break with bourgeois subjectivity and all the things that, you know, are connected to that. It's like we're bombarded with that way, that kind of individualism, that the kind of self-interested subject, autonomous subject kind of thing. We're bombarded with that, with like all the media we consume, with like everything we read, the schools we go to, the people we interact with in our jobs. It's all like that. And we see, even if you're working class, you see that way makes sense because the people that are the worst at it are like, you know, that sort of have the worst behaviors of it, are the most arrogant, the most, you know, the most individualistic and stuff like that. They're the ones that like are often CEOs, rich people writing their rich stories. And so it's like saying, well, if I act like that, maybe that's how I get ahead in the world.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. So bourgeois ideology and also like white ideology, cis-heteropatriarchy, right? All of these things.
And it's different. I'm just like, you know, I'm talking about the bourgeois one, but all that bourgeois ideology definitely connects so much with like, as you know, that whole idea of the self-interested bourgeois subject. You know, people like Sadia Hartman have pointed out that it's completely connected to slavery as well.
Absolutely.
Built like seeing that other people don't have that autonomy and they don't count as proper humans, and they
exactly.
Can be, right? So this that whole kit and caboodle of the shittiness of bourgeois ideology connected to patriarchy,
yeah,
racism, all that kind of stuff, definitely ableism, this idea that you have this autonomy, right, and things like that. Like we can just go on and on and on. Anyhow, it's like we're drawn to it, right? And so it's hard to break from. So we can like, you know, in the Maoist movements around the world and people that ascribe to it, or especially ones that I sometimes run into online or something like that, they can very well cite those articles and practices and talk about remolding, but still fail to remold themselves, right? So there can be like a dogmatism and arrogance that is often performed by self-proclaimed Maoists. Just like I'm saying, it can be proclaimed by everyone in every tradition, but since I'm talking about my tradition and one that claims it cares about this, it still can do this, right? It still slips in even if you care about it, especially online. And this demonstrates always that there is a gap between theory and practice, and just how much, even if we theoretically say we oppose that subjectivity, how much we have been socialized into it, right? So, you know, there's all, you know, examples of people will proclaim they're practicing the mass line when their activities are simply preaching at the masses and posing as revolutionary, right? Or dogmatists citing combat liberalism and calling everyone else liberals, but still continue to behave in a liberal manner, right?
Mm.
These are very real phenomena. It's all over the place. And this is why this aspect of Maoism is so difficult, right? You can't just proclaim it on paper. You really have to struggle with yourself and with others all the time, and being willing to admit you're wrong and doing all that kind of stuff. And, you know, while pursuing a mass line that doesn't tail the masses, but also doesn't talk down to them. And maybe this is where you can find some, you know, some social gospel Christian traditions. This might be why you can move them towards a Maoism, because there was always a privilege when I was growing up about, you know, admitting you're wrong and, you know, being, you know, forgiveness and, you know, like remolding and being better. Of course, it was always tied to this notion of like your faith and sin. And also there could be the same kind of arrogance to it as well. Be like, oh, I'm forgiven. You should be forgiven. Right. But it's kind of see that kind of sense of that and a further sense that Maoism tends to bring out, right? So some Maoists get the notion that, you know, part of this cultural revolution ethos is struggling against revisionism and opportunism, but then they fail to understand that part of the struggle is also a struggle against bourgeois and petty bourgeois ways of behavior that manifest as arrogance, dishonest, rhetorical know-it-all attitudes, and the fragility of personal egos. So with that in mind, struggle for an overall revolutionary culture also becomes a problem since it can lead to simplistic notions of working class culture that, you know, confuse popular culture with proletarian culture without realizing that what is popular for everyone, including the proletariat, is a commodified anti-intellectual culture produced by the bourgeoisie to basically, like, one-dimensionalize the working class.
Yeah.
Right? This simplistic perspective on proletarian culture is common for workerist Marxism-Leninism, even before Maoism, but some Maoists adopt the same shitty conceptions, right? They'll call difficult cultural forms of art and things, they'll just call that bourgeois because it's difficult, because they aren't popular. And then, but then for some reason, it's like a Hollywood film, which is a massive bourgeois institution because it's popular, somehow proletariat. Like, it's a bizarre way of seeing things, right? And this is where you get this discourse about elite intellectuals, you know, the same one that reactionaries push. And that's not what's meant by building revolutionary culture, right? Mm-hmm. And I always go back to, you know, Mao's, so when we talk about cultural revolution, I want to say it's like all forms, kind of new cultures, new personalities, new cultures we need to develop. And, you know, Mao has this great talk at the Yunnan Forum on Art, and it's really instructive, right, how he says that you need to ground yourself in what is popular, but you need to push for further new forms, right, new forms that go away from this. And he does say there can be superior art forms that are difficult to engage with, but you know, pulling people along to create a mass culture, right, create a mass culture. So we need to push for new forms of cultural expression. You can link it to like what Fanon conceived of as a new enlightenment, rather than, you know, wallow in popular culture. We need to make an accessible avant-garde revolutionary culture as part of a future subjectivity. And I know I've just kind of digressed into the realm of art and literature before getting to the religious question, but I think they're all kind of connected.
Absolutely.
Mao felt that art and literature was significant because we are cultural beings, and the art we produce not only reflects our subjectivity, but encourages others to pursue this subjectivity. And the capitalist ruling class understands this fact. And that is why they own and influence the means of culture production and bombard us with endless Hollywood films that are either simple popular films or complex, difficult films that valorize their perspective.
Yes. Right?
So revolutionary movements need to generate their own culture that is separate from bourgeois culture. But part of this generation is waging war within bourgeois-owned cultural institutions, just as workers wage war within bourgeois-owned factories. So the oppressed, and we know that the oppressed masses, look, they've always spontaneously created complex countercultural reform and forms in response to their oppression. And you look at jazz, right? You know, that's a super complex musical art form, but it's created by the most oppressed people in society, and it was hated, but it was seen as like not austere enough. The simplistic forms that were loved by like white society at that time. Mm-hmm. Hip hop is another example. We can go on and on of like oppressed people creating complex art forms, you know. And imagine if we have a countercultural movement or a revolutionary movement that combine these countercultural forms together to a movement, right? That's something that you should be thinking of having, right? This kind of notion. Anyhow, when I say that if we can imagine that we can, a movement that combined all these countercultural forms together, that I think gets us to this question, back to this question through this detour about seeing religious communities as a site for this kind of struggle. Right? So the point is to reach a level of revolutionary organization where we can struggle in all avenues for a revolutionary culture and make this culture a necessity. Right? Yet here we need to reach a level where the question of a better way of being and a superior revolutionary culture can be put to religious communities as well. Right? Do these communities want to pursue a culture in line with ruling class power, or do they want to be part of something new, even if this newness means they might have to worry about religion possibly withering away? Do these communities want a culture of complicity or a culture of struggle? And we can see how the cutting edge of these communities function in the Philippines as part of the New Democratic Front. You mentioned talking to the theologian there, right? They link their future to the culture of the People's War. So I think that's how we, that too, if we see, religious institutions as part of the general cultural spaces in which religious partisans need to struggle to establish a new humanity and a new cultural way of being, and just as we would struggle in all these spaces, right, and push this line. So I think in closing this question, I want to say, you know, something about maybe connects to some of the things you were saying about, you know, social gospel stuff, or that I've been saying as well, is something about this cultural revolution ethos. You know, I want to talk a bit about this. And, you know, and then building a new humanity and my inheritance of having been raised in a religious tradition by family members who cared about something called the social gospel. You know, because Maoism and progressive religious expressions really do converge on the way we should behave as subjects, right? Like, you know, I was taught to treat other people, no matter where they came from, as I would treat myself, to not be an arrogant asshole, and to be in communion with others as an equal. But of course, this perspective, as I pointed out, it was overdetermined by that partisan commitment to Christianity, right? So in a way, part of like when I, you know, reoriented around kind of Maoism, that was, it was demystifying that, saying there's ways I was taught not to be an asshole, how to be with other people and fix problems with them and all that kind of stuff, and put others' interests before my own, this kind of thing. It's like I did a lot of demystifying and reorienting it to turn it into like a political partisan commitment, right? So, you know, and that's how to, you know, figure out how to be like comrades and good comrades, and how to interact with the masses in a non-arrogant way. And, you know, and I always make mistakes, as we all do, but it's part of that general remolding. And generally, you know, I think that kind of, demystified perspective of that, you know, that is about, you know, treating others better than yourself, and, you know, being in community with others, but oriented towards that partisan political commitment, right? That's key to struggling together for a better world.
Yeah, that was incredible. One of the interesting questions I think you finished us with is to ask ourselves, and to take this question to our communities, is whether we want our communities to engage in a culture of complicity or a culture of struggle. And I really appreciate that final question. So Joshua, thank you so much for the conversation, for all of the investigation and the research that you brought into this conversation. In the show notes, I'll link a couple of your other conversations that you've had on Revolutionary Left Radio and on Mass. I'll link some of the books that we've mentioned. But where specifically might people be able to follow you and connect with your work?
Well, I mean, there's my blog, right? MLM Mayhem. And I think I have a list on there of like my work. Do that. I'm on Twitter, as you know. I mean, I'm trying to be less on Twitter now. Like, I haven't tweeted anything since like yesterday. I'm trying to maybe keep that up. It's getting in the way of me actually doing my job right now. I'm on there too.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, and I really appreciate you.
Okay, thanks for having me. This was a great conversation.